Hello, and thanks for joining us for today's episode of Highbrow Drivel. We're going to be talking about the weird and wonderful world of manners, how they come to be, what they're there for. We'll find out. As always, if you do enjoy the episode, please tell a friend, like, share, subscribe. They're all really helpful. I hope you enjoy.
Stephen, am I correct in saying it's Dr. Stephen Mennell?
Well, usually use professor.
Professor.
But if I were German, you would have to address me as Professor Doctor Doctor.
And so that would be, I guess let's get stuck into it. That would be the polite, well-mannered way to address you in Germany, would be Professor Doctor Doctor?
I think these days it might be considered a bit stuffy to use the double doctorate in the
yeah, I imagine it doesn't do a great job of setting you up as being relatable if you ever as you're being introduced say no, it's not professor, it's not doctor, it's Professor Doctor Doctor.
needless to say, I never go for that, but funnily enough, I think in some ways professor is more informal than doctor, but we're already into the substance of manners before you've even managed to introduce us properly, because there are so many nuances expressed in these things. But it is true, you know, American students used to always address me as Dr. Mennell. I say, bloody professor, you creep, you know. You thought that, you didn't say it.
I will end my little initial run of ill manners now and introduce our second guest, the comedian for today, Jamie D'Souza. Jamie, I hope I'm not ruining any kind of bad boy reputation or branding you had ambitions on, but you've always struck me as a well-mannered young man. Are manners important to you, and were they something that were instilled in you growing up, or what's your experience with manners so far?
See, I am so big on manners, but from other people. I think I'm a nice person, but if I hold the door open for someone and they don't say thanks afterwards, then I'm picking
them with you all picked my them mind. In the walls.
Hmm? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very impressive. You've got a professor on, or a doctor, depending on where you are. But I mean, I'm currently in the middle of a coughing fit, so I feel like the levels of qualification. We've got a professor, and we've got someone with a 2-2 in maths that can't breathe properly. That's essentially what we're dealing with. So it's.
Did you say breathe or breed?
That would make for a different podcast if I was. Bad manners if I was attempting that mid-podcast. I'm trying to breathe.
I'm sure at some point in this conversation we will get to kind of cross-global misunderstandings of manners. At some point that will happen, but I think it is safe to say that nowhere in the world would it be polite to try and breed during a semi-professional call. You mentioned big on manners when from other people, which I think is a really, really interesting and good way to put it. I am just curious, just while we're starting off this call, I think there are a lot of manners that, regardless of what we decide manners are later in the discussion, there are a lot of manners that we probably personally even just feel like, oh, we could do without that particular one. I know, just thinking off the top of my head, there are two that I wish we would get rid of. Like, if tomorrow I got to rewrite manners, there are two that I'd get rid of. One is like the idea that people bring a plate when they visit, because I find whether if you are the host, often what happens is people bring you inadequate snacks that you wouldn't buy for yourself because you like something nicer, but they're not going to pay for you to have the nice stuff. And then you don't want to put that out for other people because you don't want to be judged on your subpar snack. So what it just means is at some point in your life, you have to eat subpar snacks that you didn't intend on because somebody else gave them to you. So I think we can just get rid of that.
Sorry to interject. I think the rudeness there is not from the person requesting the plate, but it's the person who's bought such an awful snack. If it's bad to the point where the host feels ashamed giving it to other guests, that's more on the awful snack giver. You know, the stale Ferrero Rocher bringer to the party or whatever it was. Like,
wait, are you saying you're invited to a friend's like small soiree and you're bringing the exact same quality snacks to that as you would to like if you were buying for yourself? Because that is generosity, I think.
Yeah, I think you've overestimated the chance of me getting invited to a social event is already a big compliment you've paid me there. But yeah, I think I would. I think I'd try and one up them. A lot of my politeness, if you do think I'm polite, is off at, you know, a hidden desire to just one up people. So it doesn't come from a nice face always.
I've not had the problem with snacks. That's a new one to me. But there is a convention this side of the Atlantic that if you're invited to dinner with people, you take a bottle of wine. And it drives me mad when someone turns up with a bottle of absolutely corrosive stuff, you know. And in student days, there was something called Corrida, which was some dreadful mixed concoction of unknown origin, but we always called it Corroda, you know. Anyone who turned up, and it has happened, but you're fairly safe with with white wine because you can say, of course, it's not chilled. We'll have mine and ignore theirs. You know, it's a bit tricky with red wine, particularly if however, yes, back to snacks. That's a more ordinary every day.
I do think, Jamie, that you have already just increased your chances of being invited to a party off the back of people knowing that your turning up means a higher quality of snack for everybody. I think
I'm classy. You know, if people do ask for a drink, I always bring a lovely white bottle of Smirnoff Ice. that's the level of class that I'll bring to you.
I mean, the plus side of that is potentially, depending on how stuck into that they get, may not remember who brought it anyway. So it's reason roundabout. Dr. Mennell, did you have a manner etiquette thing that we abide by? If you could get rid of one, that would be the first one you'd strike off the list?
Well, I think you've already referred to my pet hate, which is the still persistent idea that men should open the door for women and always walk on the outside, which I don't mind so much, but opening doors introduces an incredible degree of uncertainty. I think its origins, so many of the ways in which men traditionally in, you know, good society apparently deferred to women, it was actually, as you were hinting, a way of expressing superiority and the subservient position of women. It's a paradoxical thing that we could easily get rid of, but largely it has gone out, but it still persists a bit. And as you were saying, I think Jamie was saying that if you do it, you can get abused. You know, you open the door for a woman and they accuse you of being a male chauvinist pig. So the modern convention, I'm told, from the manners books, is whoever gets to the door first opens it for the other.
Yeah, absolutely. That I thought that was. I wouldn't slam the door in the face of someone. Turn around, see they're a bloke, and they're like, "Ah, f you!" Like, and slam.
I am super curious because so obviously that one is a poor one. I think anywhere where a convention or a manner, as it starts to fade out of fashionability and you have that moment of do we, don't we, is a real cause for concern. Like even just standing up to greet somebody and, you know, you go to do it and realize nobody else does and you get caught in like a half crouch, half seat. It just has to be blanket rules. With the door in particular, though, you mentioned that there is a degree of power and control in that. To what extent was that once upon a time being a like, I am opening this door to let you through, and if I did not, you should not be going through sort of exercise of like actually explicit control?
Well, isn't it more a matter of saying, you know, you are a poor, weak woman, you would not even be capable of having the strength to open the bloody door in the first place? I think it's more that subtle kind of thing rather than trying to say that they're not entitled to pass through.
That's fair, but I've stopped saying that to women when I do open the door for them now, and I found it hasn't.
Yeah, I imagine it would not date well, Jamie. And here I was at the top of the call saying what a well-mannered young man you are. One of the things that I found interesting when I was researching this was one of the earliest, apparently, examples of recorded manners dates back to 2400 BC. And apparently one of the rules in that is that you should laugh when your superior laughs. Uh-oh. As to show agreement, which I find a super, like, I am so jealous. Like, I wish anybody who was socially inferior to me, I could be like, no, you all have to laugh when I do, because it would make my job on stage a lot easier. But secondly, how much of manners is that or has evolved from some kind of, I guess, exertion of power over people?
Well, the way you posed the question in advance of this session, you've just reformulated it, but it struck me as a little bit primitive. You know, you've got to get away from the kind of... if I may come on heavy academic, you know, you've got to get away from Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and the sort of a contract theory of how society forms. The problem with manners is that by and large, no one creates them consciously. They emerge, they are hit upon, they often are hit upon as a means of expressing social superiority or social subordination, but they change over time. And so I'm not remotely surprised that the example that you gave of, 2,000 years ago, the point is all societies have some sort of conventions about manners. And, you know, my particular intellectual hero, Norbert Elias, wrote about this, saying that actually there's no zero point. Now, people who read his book before, well, certainly in the early days, this is the book called The Civilizing Process or on the Process of Civilization, people actually read it as, you know, very entertaining comic book. And And because the most famous bit of it is huge, by the way, but, you know, the most famous chunk of it is about manners to do with table manners. Yes, well, you know, toilet habits, you know, which he refers to how, you know, manners regarding the natural functions. But he was writing just before the Second World War, when you couldn't talk about social conventions about shitting and pissing, particularly if you're a professor, and spitting, and what else, blowing your nose, and people, you know, he depicts it in gruesome detail, but there are always some rules, and the reason that those horrible things are discussed, say, in the medieval and early modern European books, and why they're so interesting, is that all society, in all societies and all times, going back to, you know, beyond the year dot, all those natural functions are things that every human being has to deal with. That, you know, there are conventions about, you know, going to the loo, to use the euphemism, and you can't get away with it. And every society we know of has some of these conventions. There are also changes, but basically there are always some rules about manners which have largely been hit upon as a way of saying, you know, this is the correct way. And if you don't observe the correct way, if you don't, you know, go to a private place to relieve yourself, it will cause huge embarrassment and you'll be regarded as socially inferior to boot. Nevertheless, it's amazing how recent it is that people began, relatively recent it is, that people began to feel embarrassment and shame at being caught in the act, so to speak. You know, the medieval books have rules about it. They say things like, if you should happen to encounter a friend who is in the act of defecation, it is bad manners to engage him in conversation.
Well,
but then, and the point is, some things like that then disappear from the manners books altogether because they become too embarrassing to mention.
Jamie, have you ever had to engage a friend in polite conversation as they've been in the act of defecation?
Not at all, and that would horrify me. I find any scatological matters just disgust me. Even if someone's talking about it on stage, I can't get into it. But what is a double standard? If someone's having a wee, I don't mind it. I'll have a chat with someone about a urinal, like a friend.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not just using it as a place for small talk, but it's a lot more like palatable, I think.
Do you know what I find funny about that is, again, there are kind of unwritten rules even around that in terms of where you place yourself at a urinal roughly to make sure you're leaving, to some extent, the maximum amount of personal space while between yourself and strangers while urinating. But one thing that, again, it gets left off those lists because it should be common sense, but in personal experience is not as common as it should do, is nobody talks about the fact that if you strike up a conversation at the urinal, make sure you continue to face forward. Because I have had a situation with a stranger who decided to try and have a chat and was drunk enough that turned full body and I had to kind of dodge the piss, which is something you shouldn't need to be told.
Can I tell you a urinal-based story, which maybe...
yes,
comes into manners. So this happened to, this is quite gruesome, so sorry. A man, well, not gruesome, but it's a bit rude, but my mate was at a urinal next to an old man, right? And apparently he was quite frail, and my friend noticed that his knees started wobbling, the old man. his knees were going and he went to fall down, and instinctively my mate turned mid-wee to catch him.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I'll let you fill in the blanks of what happened. But the man was very angry, and I think that's entirely understandable. But do you think my mate did the right thing in that situation?
I think this is one that obviously you can't have a rule book for each fringe case, but I'm going to mark this one up as wrong, like, did the wrong thing for the right reason, right? Like, you should not be accidentally or otherwise pissing on anybody. But also, had the situation ended differently, which your friend did not know how it would end, the man would have been falling into a urinal anyway and therefore been covered it with piss and potentially had a head wound. So, you know, lesser of the evils.
That's true. He did all he could, apart from not piss on an old man.
Yeah. I mean, it is a fundamental thing you should not do, but also, what are you going to do?
10 out of 10 for intention, I think 0 out of 10 for execution.
Absolutely. So we have touched a little bit on cross-cultural manners, and it is interesting to me because one of the first times I started paying attention to them more as an adult was actually after I moved to the UK, because I think a lot of the things you are taught are correct and polite as a child in Australia, kind of, it is not seen as rude if an adult drops off a lot of the formalities. And I think that's the way Australians would consider it, that some of the manners side of things are quite formal here. But one thing that I did realize is that in maintaining an adherence to manners in the UK, there is a degree of passive aggression that comes with that I don't know even if a lot of English people notice, to the point where, like, up until I moved to England, I had never appreciated how weaponized the word sorry could be. And then, like, you go to the tube once and you see, like, a 6'8" rugby player running the wrong way up a escalator, pushing women and children out the way, going, sorry, sorry, sorry. And you go, oh, well, he's showing his manners, maybe. Like, at least he's being polite about the fact that he's a dickhead. Whereas in Australia, we'd be much more likely to say, get the fuck out of my way, but we probably wouldn't be pushing people as we did it. I'm curious as to whether you guys, how you experience that degree of manners and whether you're aware of the passive aggression from the outside.
I totally feel so. I grew up in Staines, which is a town in Surrey, which, and like Surrey in terms of the UK, is probably the most buttoned down, repressed, polite place, I would say. But then I lived in Cardiff for a bit, which is probably like a bit kind of more on the way to like Australia in terms of, like, everything's a lot more informal and people just talk to you more like on the level rather than like manners. And it is, you're so right. It's just someone will say thank you, but what they mean is you need to go fuck yourself right. It's so subtle the way they say it. But I find in Cardiff, if someone, they might not say thank you as much. I mean, maybe this is just me, but when they do say it, they mean it. And there's less of the artifice around it. It was my impression of things.
Yeah. And I come from Yorkshire and we're supposedly, and I think actually famous for, we're famous for bluntness, and I think it's actually true. And I think anyhow, we'd be more like Wales. When I came to live in Ireland, one of my new friends trying to sort of induct me into Irish culture made the point that the north of England, the story was that when I it was announced that I'd been appointed when I was coming from Australia, apparently it was said in the senior common room, it's an Englishman and long faces all round. And then they said, he's a Yorkshireman. Oh, that's all right. it was explained to me that the north of England and Ireland and Scotland, for that matter, and probably Wales, they're not really very much different from each other. But the big difference is we've both poncified southerners.
Thank you very much.
Of course, I'm actually married to a poncified southerner. train her out of it a bit. But I recognise all of that. But, you know, there is a point. I think it may be particularly well developed. Historically, I think that good manners, particularly in the south of England, you know, think Downton Abbey, that good manners were absolutely mobilised as an expression of superiority and putting people down. But you see, the other side of this said that manners change. There's also the problem of what I call the concertina effect. And that is that upper class people develop, probably unconsciously at first, but the, you know, conventions change without anyone knowing quite how the convention came to change, and upper class people behave in a certain way, and it's a way of expressing their superiority, and then the, you know, the upper middle classes, I think Gilbert and Sullivan, you know, bow, bow, you lower middle classes. The middle classes begin to see this and then begin to imitate in what one famous sociologist called anticipatory socialization. If you want to identify with the upper class, you begin in advance to copy their manner. Of course, that puts pressure on the upper classes, who then have to differentiate. They have to pull out the concertina further to increase the distance between them and the hoi polloi. And that seems to have been one of the mechanisms that has run through European history, Western European history, anyhow, say from the 15th to the 19th century. I'm not sure, though, where the modern trend to informalization fits in.
It is interesting to think that we have societal behaviors that everybody is judged upon and is dictated in the way that we interact with each other at a subconscious level that essentially boils down to some extent to rich people really wanting you to know that they're better than you.
Yeah.
So I was in my research reading that at one point in the late 1890s, it was thought in England to be impolite to ask somebody a direct question, which means I've been incredibly impolite for the first 45 minutes of this recording. But also, when I read that, I was super curious to... My first thought was like, oh, is that why English people are so sarcastic, as a kind of rebellion? Like, oh, I can't ask a question directly. Watch how scathingly indirect I can be with my question. See how you like it then. I guess there's two questions. First, Jamie, have you ever been forced into some kind of creative rebellion by repressive rules? And then secondly, Dr. Menno, do you have any thoughts on the way that manners indirectly create behaviours in society?
Well, I think definitely, have you ever worked in a shop like Tesco's or anything like that? Like, I find when you get, I once had a customer complain. So I was working on the tills, and so I saw this person come in, right? And they came and they did their shop, and then they put some ice cream on my aisle, and they went, "Can you see this ice cream? It's melted. That is unacceptable." Now, I don't think that that is my fault, right? I think I'm not to blame, but you know, it was in Waitrose. The customer's always right. I had to just go, you know, and that's a moment where you turn the politeness up to 11. And you're just like, "Sir, I'm so sorry. I really wish, let me see what I can do." I mean, obviously I know what I can do, and that is get another ice cream from the thing. I just went for, you know, just overdid it on the manners, which I think a lot of people have done who work in shops, who are dealing with difficult customers who are being assholes.
I never thought about this being a convention of not asking direct questions, and it's quite clever, your suggestion about its relation to sarcasm. The nearest I know to it, you know, in the etiquette books, is that, first of all, you need to know that apparently the most frequent dream that people have in England is meeting the Queen.
That sounds like,
this is a fact, apparently. I don't know about Wales and Scotland, but apparently it's quite well documented. And, of course, you never do. Just as a footnote, when I came to Ireland, I almost immediately met the President of the Republic, the champion. small country are very different. However, back to the Queen. What is said, and people are briefed on this, you know, in advance. You are going to meet the Queen or some other member of the royal family, you know, and you must not ask any questions. And I went, how the hell can you have a conversation? And the answer is that you have to wait for this person, this royal personage, to ask you a question, which is usual. And what do you do? You know.
You mentioned that the number one dream that English people have is meeting the Queen. I don't know if this is directly related to manners, but what I do think is funny about that is definitely my grandparents' generation. And like, there are two cultures in my mother's side and my father's side are very different culturally. My mother's Australian and my father's Mauritian. And both of those cultures, despite being very different in their upbringing and expression, my grandparents on both sides had cutlery that I think is quite common, cutlery that was pretty much never used. It was like the fancy cutlery. And no matter who came over, and we had visitors from overseas and we'd have, you know, special guests and fiancés and all of this, and you never used the good cutlery to the point where everybody kind of jokes that it's quite literally for the Queen coming over. Jamie, did you and your family have similar sort of, I guess, fancy things that were never used at all?
Do you know what? I think that is a general, that's definitely a thing that like seemingly most people in the UK have. My parents are, I don't know if it's like an Indian parent thing, but we had like almost the opposite. Until I was like probably like 18, we didn't have any glasses in our house. We were just using plastic cups and things like that.
Mm.
I think my parents aren't, they're not one for ceremony. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Guests came around, they're just drinking out of a bright red tumbler.
in the north of England, in my day, what we used to call the respectable working class, the skilled working class equals more or less the respectable working class. But living in small houses, which didn't have, you know, an abundance of room, nevertheless, most families had a front room, or it was often called the room, where, you know, and they probably had the cutlery in a cupboard there as well. But it was hardly ever used. It was bizarre, you know. I mean, it was not there. I think at Christmas you would go and sit in the room and pretend to be happy.
I think the most bizarre thing about that is, as a millennial who, you know, is kind of just worn down by the expectation that whatever space you rent could almost always be used as a closet in previous eras, it is just bizarre to think of people paying for excess real estate for a room that is not used.
Well, I think rents, house prices in Britain will have eliminated such social fossils as the room.
I mean, that room is now being rented out as a three-bedroom that has been subdivided. We are talking a little bit about dining and culture, and I am super interested around, and you even mentioned earlier, Dr. Menel, that Norbert Elias has a complete thing around table manners. Mm. Why are so much of manners tied into the ritual of eating? I have heard, although I've not fact-checked, for example, that one of the reasons, I don't know if it's the knife being on the right or left, I actually don't know which side it is on, but one of the reasons was because at the royal court, pre-like dining cutlery, they had like kind of swordy knives that were closer to swords, and a king wanted to be able to see if somebody was reaching across to make an assassination attempt. Is that actually true? Is there any truth to that myth? And if not, then where and why is there so much fascination in dining with manners?
Oh, well, everyone has to eat is the very brief answer. But again, you know, things have changed so much. There was never a time when there were no manners in Western Europe, is what I know most about. I mean, very little change, as far as we can judge, in the Middle Ages, century after century, the same manners were reported in the manners books in English, French, German, Italian. Nevertheless, there were some rules, and they included things like if you find there's something in your mouth that is, you know, a gristly bit of meat, something you cannot chew, it is bad manners to put it back in the common bowl. Good manners were to throw it on the floor. It is bad manners if you have come across a particularly juicy morsel, it is bad manners to take it out of your mouth and offer it to your neighbour to chew. But, you know, and these things became utterly, many more rules came in. But it's interesting, that particular one, the circumstances in which you see occasionally people taking it out of their mouth and giving it to their someone else to chew is mothers with babies, of course, forming polite habits of that kind starts very early. But you know, the rules, even medieval rules, were broken by mothers and their babies. However, by the late 17th century, another manners book that Elias cite, it says, you know, do not help your, if you have had, do not use your spoon. By that, this time, they really do have individual spoons. Do not use it to help you, to go into the soup tureen to serve yourself with a second helping. And he says, there are now some people who are so delicate, si délicat, so precious, they will refuse to have anything, any more soup themselves from the tureen if they know you've contaminated it with your own spoon, which has been in your mouth. And, you know, it seems bizarre, but that's a new feeling. And he's commenting that there are some people are so precious they don't like to see this. And it's a feeling of disgust. And disgust is increasing. The frontier of disgust, if you like, is increasing. And Elias says it's, you know, there is an invisible wall of emotions growing up between people's bodies.
So a question I have around that, because I find it super funny, particularly in today's climate, to think that there was ever oh my God, who wouldn't, like, why would you be so delicate as to not want to eat spoon soup after somebody else has double dipped their spoon into it? I'm super curious, and I guess, Jamie, love to hear if you've got some out there, or just any examples really of, I guess, things that may become manners as a result of the fact that, you know, we've been super, I guess, hygiene conscious in a way that we haven't societally been. Like, for one, I don't want to shake anybody's hands ever again.
Yeah.
That's probably the first one. Anybody who's talking too close into a mic at a stage, I don't want to be near that mic ever again. Like, what are some that you think might happen?
I think, like, that when someone sneezes on the tube, it's going to take a long time, or on any public transport, it's going to take a long time for someone to not look at them with complete disgust. Do you know what I mean? And fear.
Yeah.
I think shaking hands is the big one. It's like, when you think about it, it's like we didn't really need to be doing that.
And what about what about the Japanese bowing to each other? We regard that as very funny and over formal, but at least it has its advantages in a pandemic.
I mean, shaking hands is one of those things where there is never like the net positive, like the absolute best case of a handshake is that it is not unpleasant, and anything less than the best is unpleasant. Somebody's hands is too clammy, their grip is too weak, their grip is too strong. All of that has an ick to it for different reasons.
I'm shaking a clammy hand now.
Oh,
it'd ruin your month.
remember that to shake hands was very intimate in the first half of the 19th century in England. Jane Austen's heroines would have been horrified if a man had offered them his hand at an early stage in their acquaintance. And North and South, Elizabeth Gaskell's book. The heroine goes from sheltered upbringing in Aurora as a clergyman's daughter in Hampshire or somewhere like that, and they go up to Manchester. And mixing with the new working class and particularly the business class. And the business class all shake hands immediately. It's the modern, it's the convention that took the place of the old conventions about bowing and so on. But this is an interesting example because it may be an example of trickle up. We tend to think of manners as trickling down a social scale, ways of rather funny ways of demonstrating your social superiority. But one of the things that happens when in a more egalitarian, relatively more egalitarian society is that the habits of the lower orders are adopted by the superiors. And so, you can see lots of examples of that, I think, in Britain now.
That's interesting. One thing I find with a handshake is that there's obviously loads of manners goes into handshakes. I'm sure you've heard that thing where they say, if you're shaking someone's hand and someone's trying to prove that they're the alpha male of the situation, they'll do a firm handshake and they'll put their hand on the top.
It's
obvious that someone's trying to do that. And they're like, I need to show my authority in some way that it almost has the opposite effect for me. Because when someone shakes my hand like that, I'm like, oh, this really means a lot to you. Like, you're really trying to prove a point here. You must be kind of insecure about something.
I would say that's one of those really funny, like, as you said, it's like these social cue rules. I don't even know if they're manners, although I'm sure Dr. Manel can help us. But where people say, if you do this, people are subconsciously reading this into it, and then everybody knows. And then, as you said, the only people who act on it are people who clearly have some kind of insecurity around that behavior, whatever that may be. And so it just becomes this massive lightning rod for, you don't think you're as masculine as you'd like, do you? Oh, precious. So are those kind of weird social cues that kind of end up in often kind of entrepreneurial self-help books in today? Would they be considered manners? Are they something else? And to what extent is some of manners kind of interpreting things that are biological or psychological cues and trying to create rules around them?
That shut us up. Do you want to go at that one, Jamie?
Yes, I feel like my 2-2 in maths will really help out this situation. But yeah, no, I'm not sure. This is the answer.
I'm not sure either. sorry. Rephrase your question, Mr. Chairman.
I guess the what I am curious about in a lot of this is so I know that you've kind of mentioned that there is often it is hard to get to the etymology of what a particular manner is because it evolves over time. And I'm curious, though, as to whether there is an expectation or an understanding or a hypothesis as to how much of manners is created for a purpose or to make with an express intention in mind, and how much of manners is people, particularly before like mass consumer psychology was the thing, people kind of creating rules around what they thought behaviors meant at a psychological or behavioral level, and then writing rules to not look, you know, not look overly promiscuous, not look overly informal, not look overly dull or stupid or anything. And those manners were written down because somewhere somebody thought that behavior had some kind of biological or personal inference.
Wow.
Did that still strike true on that question?
Well, what came to mind was these appalling people in business schools who write books about corporate behavior, most of which turns my teeth on edge, you know. But on the whole, I don't think there is much conscious creation of rules. The mystery in some ways is how it becomes hardened into habit. How does a social convention become deeply ingrained psychology? And we can see that historically. It's a bit more difficult to see the way things are going now. But, I mean, the big trend of the last century, I suppose, has been informalization. And that's actually quite difficult to understand. Actually, again, going back to all the way to Elias writing just on the eve of the Second World War, he talked about, you know, we have one thing we haven't talked about, which is also in his book, is the problem of what he called behavior in the bedroom, by which he doesn't mean it doesn't mean anything quite as exciting as you might imagine, dressing and undressing. And anyhow, he in a bit of a speculative passage later on, he points out that some of what he seems to have been tracing, the long trend of formalization that we've been talking about to some extent, you know, the development of more and more elaborate manners as a mark of social superiority. He says that, for example, it is now possible, he says, for mixed company to appear in what he describes as something like scanty bathing costumes, far more revealing of the body than, say, in the Victorian period. Of course, he's talking about the 1930s when, you know, they wore bathing costumes that we would regard as unbelievably conservative and long before the bikini, for example. But it leads him to speculate, you know, has his historic trend gone into reverse because of greater social equality and so on in the 20th century? Or is it rather that the level of ingrained self-control has actually risen, if you like what he calls the civilizing process, has actually continued, and it's that's permitting all sorts of informalization? And my old friend Casavaltes, a Dutch sociologist, has spent 40, 50 years researching on this. But, you know, on the whole, what seems to be the point is that, to take that bathing example, on the whole, women, perhaps men as well, do not feel that they're going to be sexually assaulted on a beach. It does occasionally happen, of course, but you know, the chances of people, there's a level of mutually expected self-restraint, as it's been called. You see this in all sorts of ways. You know, we started by talking about forms of address, you know, whether you address people as sir or professor or doctor and that kind of thing. But, you know, when I first had just as a teenager, I had a temporary job in an office where the clerk, the senior clerk who sat at the front looking at us junior clerks, he was always addressed as Mr. Heath. You know, never, I think his name was Jeff. No one would ever have called him Jeff. But in a certain sense, yeah, that would be regarded as unbelievably formal now, and everyone uses Christian name. But yet, even that depends on to a certain extent on people having an ingrained self-restraint in not taking advantage of apparent surface informality. Shall I stop lecturing now?
Yeah, I do find that fascinating. So to some extent, just to check that I followed, the question you're kind of asking is the kind of informalization of some of the rules that were bound in manners, is that only possible and accepted and expressed and able to be expressed because there is a kind of underlying trust that people will show restraint that potentially they did not trust they would in the past?
Yeah, precisely.
That is super interesting. And when you put it like that in terms of workplace kind of etiquette, I find that super interesting as well, because like I spent a bunch of time working at creative agencies, so advertising agencies that wanted to pretend to be fancier and cooler than actual advertising agencies. And in terms of that like level of freedom and informality that is kind of backed up by a level of trust and implicit self-control, is that, you know, we'd have pinball tables and table tennis tables and all of these kind of fun distractions and informalities in the office. And the idea was you could go and play at any time, but also your day was going to be, when you started on Monday, if you had a 40-hour contract, there was 60 hours worth of work. So if you ever went and played a video game, that's on your time going home. It's never on the company time. And there is a lot of that in corporate culture now, where it's like you can take infinite days of annual leave, but also you still have to get everything done and we're going to give you too much to do. And I do think that at least in corporate culture, that is a big thing of like, we're going to make it feel like home. We're going to make it feel like friends. But implicit in all of that is that suffer. You're going to have too much to do to ever enjoy the actual tangible benefits of a lot of this stuff anyway.
Yeah. No, that rings true to me.
I did see, it's always ridiculous when a comedian quotes a meme, but I think in the case of this, I think it's quite fitting. I saw something that was like, you know, organizations, we care about your mental health and well-being and work-life balance, so we're making changes. People, cool, are you going to give us a sustainable workload and a workforce to handle the work that we've got? Workplace, no, we're doing yogas on Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah, the infinite ways of politely screwing people.
With my job, a lot of those things are just a burden. Like they'll add more wellness stuff. They do a thing at my work called Lunch and Learns, which is basically you can not do a lunch break and watch someone bore on about data analysis for an hour instead.
Oh God!
Why?
Yeah, I I find those, yeah, as you said, the impolite, polite burdens, even at the moment, like obviously every workplace is trying hard to create some sense of socialization around the remote working, which means that, you know, a lot of offices have like lunchtime Zoom calls. And I could think of nothing, A, less polite and B, less fun than eating my lunch over a fucking Zoom call.
Exactly, because when I was in the office, that lunch hour, that was the hour to myself. You know, I'd just go on my own, sit on a park bench and eat my lunch. And it's have that time to yourself, I think, because that's the whole point. Like when you're in an office, you're constantly talking to people and like, you know, your colleagues and stuff. It's just, yeah, it seems like a strange thing that that's the hour they take away from people. You know, if it was during like an actual work hour, I could understand it more, you know.
Yeah. Cool. One more thing I was super interested in as we start to come towards the end of the chat is, what are some manners that you both, I guess, Jamie, you first, think should exist but currently do not?
Ooh, that's a good question. One thing I really like, which you guys will probably disagree because it's completely pointless, but you know, arguing over a bill in the positive way, and that like, no, I insist we'll get that. I like that whole like construct of it, even like, because when it happens, you generally know who's paying for the bill, but I like it when two people both, or two parties both kind of insist that they'll pay it for a bit. It's like a tennis match of who can be more polite. And I just want to see I want to see that in more places. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. I'm trying to think where it could be.
I do think with the arguing over who will pay the bill in terms of both putting it forward that they will, I think one of the reasons that is so endearing, and I don't know if this is the same with you, Jamie, is just that it is so endearing in comparison to the opposite, which I've also seen way too much, which is people like pulling out their calculator to work out to the nearest decimal how much they should pay.
Diet Coke's actually 10p cheaper, so let's not split the bill. It's just like, I hate that. I have a lot of friends like that. One thing I would actually, so this is not manners, but kind of a reaction to manners, but I think one thing I would like to see is if there is a friend who shirks on getting a round in more often than not, I think that should be punishable by death.
I think at the very least punishable by never being allowed to get around. I do think, again, this is where that the British passive aggression thing gets me, is that I definitely think that is a British thing to keep letting him get rounds. In Australia, if you have a mate who we call it the Copperfield, where you disappear at the time that it becomes your round. If you have a mate who is notorious for that, quite early on, like if it happens twice, it'll be kind of a race for somebody to be the next time, hey, you don't get to come into our round because you notoriously disappear. Whereas I think it is such an English thing to just keep buying this person drinks and hating them for it. Oh,
do you know, can I tell you one thing that happened with a friend of mine? This irks me to this day, and it happened about 4 years ago. But my girlfriend at the time was meeting all my friends, like for the first time. So she was quite nervous and all that kind of stuff. But we were in like a nightclub, and my girlfriend at the time brought a round of shots in for everyone, which, you know, as a way to endear herself, very polite thing to do. We've got one mate who's so careful with money. Like normally in that situation, like a round of shots, you don't have to reimburse them, right? You maybe get a drink later. My friend's way of reimbursing my girlfriend at the time was to buy her one shot of vodka.
Oh, no!
So, poor her, she'd never met anyone before, and now she just has to slowly sip one shot of Sambuca in front of everyone. She was trying to pay back her debt, my friend was, but I feel like she was like totally wrong, and the best thing to do in that situation is just not... It's more polite to just not get someone a drink in that situation. Get everyone one.
I don't think you should say thanks for having me. I become spread from America, and I'm being rude now, but it should be dropped, particularly when you're abnegating yourself to some, say, BBC entrepreneur, and you're doing him a favour. But it always reminds me of, it was one of those sort of slightly comic detectives. And finally, towards the end of the series, the male hero finally got to bed his female sidekick, and I always remember her line. She said, "Thank you for having me." And every time I hear someone say, "Thank you for having me," I think it sounds as though they've just been satisfyingly screwed. However,
we have already discussed at the top of this call that any sexual content during a podcast recording would be terrible manners.
We were breeding all along. That's the pullback and reveal for this.
But in spite of all that, Anthony, thanks for having me.
Sorry for the Americanism. If I can go, thanks for having me. It's been totally awesome, dude. I've had had a rad time.
And that was that. Thanks again to Professor Stephen Mennell and Jamie D'Souza for being our guest. If you like them, please go to the show notes, check out their other work, and as always, support the show however you can. We appreciate it. Take care, and we'll talk to you next week.